Thank you very much, Lathan, for the kind invitation. So what happens operationally as one approaches the Planck scale? Let's just review a very basic argument. If you want to resolve a distance more and more precisely, then a smaller position uncertainty will trigger a larger momentum uncertainty. And eventually, as the momentum uncertainty becomes very large, since momentum curves space just like energy does, we expect a curvature uncertainty. And eventually, if we don't know exactly what the curvature is between two points, how can we know what their distance is either? So we start with trying to resolve distances very accurately. We end up increasing momentum uncertainty, increasing the curvature uncertainty, and that eventually leads to an uncertainty in distances again. So a back of the envelope calculation shows that there ought to be a limit to how far the notion of distance makes sense, probably down to about 10 to the minus 35 meters. Now, what then is the structure of space-time? There's a paradox. On one hand, general relativity would have it that space is a differentiable manifold. Fields live on a differentiable manifold. On the other hand, quantum field theory doesn't really agree with that, and quantum field theory would be much better defined. In fact, it would be well defined only if it is defined on a lattice. So how can we reconcile the two? Is general relativity winning, or is quantum field theory ultimately winning? Well, there are many proposed resolutions to this conundrum, and one possible resolution is in this suggestion. Studies in quantum gravity and string theory have put up the possibility that the uncertainty principle might be slightly modified. And instead of being hyperbolic and approaching this axis asymptotically and approaching that axis asymptotically, there might be a finite gap here, so that we cannot make delta x arbitrarily small. That would be, in a way, the simplest way of implementing the idea that we cannot resolve distances arbitrarily accurately. We are not resorting to any assumptions that go beyond the established theories of quantum theory and general relativity by saying that it's just a quantum uncertainty. It's just the usual quantum uncertainty that cannot be made any smaller than a finite minimum uncertainty. Now, this structure also arises, it arises not just from various studies of quantum gravity and string theory, where it comes from t-duality. It also comes from quantum groups and non-commutative geometry. This came out of my PhD thesis. If you take the quantum group SUQN and define raising and lowering operator commutation relations that are symmetric, that are preserved under the action of that quantum group, then you pick up some non-trivial commutator here. And once you have those A and A dagger operators, you can then define position and momentum operators simply by taking their real part or their Hermitian part and their anti-Hermitian part. And then you find modified commutation relations for the X and the P. They are a little complicated. I spare you the trouble of reading them all. Here is the equation that you get for one dimension. If you just reduce what you've seen with the n dimensions to one dimension, this is what you obtain. And you see that phase space is changed. It's a bit like what Laurent was saying a little earlier. Phase space is changed here in such a way that when you calculate the uncertainty principle that comes from that, you obtain this kind of uncertainty principle. In fact, it's a little more general because you can have a gap here and a gap there, a finite minimum uncertainty in position and or a finite minimum uncertainty in momentum. However, as this case of one dimension already indicates, this is not really tied to quantum groups. You can have this short distance structure with quantum groups or with ordinary symmetries. It's really not related to the symmetries. It's just that it came out of studies of quantum groups anyway, but So it's compatible with that, but it's not tied to the mathematics of quantum groups. You can make that compatible with the usual symmetries of space-time as well. So what then is really the mathematics behind that? If it's not the deformation into quantum groups and non-commutative geometry.
Sorry, you mean quantum group X on this algebra?
Yeah. So these are basically quantum planes.
Okay.
I also wrote a paper with Martin Boyerwald in which we show that it depends on whether Q has got to be real for this to work. And if Q is larger than 1, you get this. Larger or equal to 1. And if Q is smaller than 1, you get a structure that's a little reminiscent to structures that you get in loop quantum gravity. So what then is the mathematics behind that kind of uncertainty principle? Well, it turns out that if the uncertainty principle has this structure, no particular functional behavior, but a gap. That's all we require. If there's a gap, if there's a finite minimum uncertainty in position, this means that fields, physical fields, must possess a finite bandwidth. You can probably see easily why the opposite is true, why the other direction is true. You see, if you have fields of a finite bandwidth, then you don't have all frequencies in them, spatially or temporally. They don't have all frequencies or all wavelengths in them. But in order to produce a delta function, you need all frequencies. And the delta function is what you need in order to make delta x equal to 0. So if fields are band limited, you get that. But you can also prove that if you have this, they are band limited. It's a functional analytic structure that's behind this. It's the mathematics of symmetric but not self-adjoint operators on Hilbert space. But the details of that are not so important. The main thing is that this implies band limitation of the physical fields. Now, band limitation is a central concept in information theory. So, it's a central concept in information theory. But what can we then deduce from that? Well, it turns out that if physical fields are band limited, then it means that we can resolve that conundrum that we talked about earlier. Namely, if you remember, who's winning here? General relativity says space-time really ought to be a differentiable manifold. The whole framework is most naturally formulated on differentiable manifolds. Quantum field theory says, no, space-time better be discrete. That's what quantization really means, discretization, literally. So who's winning here? Well, it turns out that with fields being band limited, both can win. Space-time can be both discrete and continuous completely equivalently at the same time, simultaneously.
Is that anything like the wave particle nature of?
It sounds like it, yes, but I haven't been able to make the connection between the two. Really what it's like is the connection is exact, the equivalence is exactly the same as what you have for information. Information is simultaneously discrete and continuous. And the mathematics of that is the same as the mathematics of physical fields in this case. So the statement is that this leads to band limitation. Band limitation offers a way to see that space-time can be both discrete and continuous in exactly the same mathematical way that information can be represented both continuously and discretely. Let me remind you how that works. So what is the role of band limitation in information theory? Well, information can come in continuous form, such as speech or music, the continuous signal. On the other hand, information can also come in the form of letters and numbers in a discrete way. When Claude Shannon in the 1940s invented or discovered information theory, he initially developed this information theory for this kind of information. And then he thought, well, what can we do with this? That seems hopeless. It would seem that we have to record the amplitude of a continuous signal at every point in time in order to capture it. But how many points are there? Uncountably many. We don't even know how to start counting them. So it would seem like there's just infinitely more information in a continuous signal than there is in a discrete signal. However, Shannon remembered a theorem that goes back ultimately to Borel and Cauchy, a theorem that now carries his name, but not because he came up with it, but because he found the key application for it in information theory. And that theorem gave rise to the theory of sampling theory. It is now the bridge between continuous representations of information and discrete representations of information. It relies on band limitation, and it plays a crucial role in all of communication engineering and signal processing, in scientific data taking, for example, in astronomy. So what is that? What did Shannon do to unify the two forms of information? So Shannon's basic sampling theorem is this. And it's really just the basic thing of it, the basic theorem. Sampling theory is, because it's so important in engineering, a very active field. And there are conferences every year, there are many journals dedicated to the subject. This is just the basics of it. So let's assume f is band limited. F is a signal, f of x, x being the real line. And to say that it's band limited means it contains only frequencies in a finite range. So it's the Fourier transform of a function over just a finite frequency interval, the maximum frequency being omega max. So let's assume f is a band limited function, and here I plotted an example of such a function. Then the sampling theorem says that if we take samples, which is to say if we record the amplitudes of that signal at discrete points on the axis, and if those points have this spacing of maximally 1 over 2 omega max, so for example, for music, typically the cutoff is about 20 kilohertz, then the theorem requires you to take 40,000 samples per second. See, there's a factor of 2 in here, 40,000 samples per second. And then, if you record those samples, you've recorded the music. Everything about it, and not just at the amplitudes, you can now reconstruct what the music is everywhere without any error in principle. I mean, there may be an error because of measurement errors, but in principle, there's no error. This is the reconstruction formula. Here are the discrete amplitudes, the amplitudes at discrete points. Here's the so-called reconstruction kernel. You have to sum over all samples, and this gives you the function everywhere. And no error. There's no approximation in this. You see, you can record in this way the music signal, which is definitely a continuous signal, has no trace of an underlying lattice. But you can record it on an underlying lattice, and you get everything about it. You don't have to choose particular points. You can also shift your sampling lattice to the right or to the left by any amount you like. You don't even have to take your samples equidistantly. You can leave gaps if you make up for them some other place. The reconstruction formula will become more complicated when you do that. But you can still reconstruct. You have to pay a price, which is that the sensitivity to measurement errors becomes larger. But you can still do it.
These were assumed to be uniformly distributed.
In this case, they are uniformly distributed. That's right. In fact, equidistantly distributed.
Yeah, yeah.
Yes. But if you make it non-equidistant, you can still reconstruct. It's just less stable. You can still do it. So what you have is that this continuous information has infinitely many representations on a lattice. And you're not tied to any particular lattice. Any discretization is as good as any other. They're all valid. You can always reconstruct perfectly. Except the spacing has to be on average at most this much.
Is that what happens on a compact disk?
Exactly that. Yes. This reconstruction formula is built into any smartphone. Any CD player, any computer uses it all the time. And what these conferences about sampling theory are about is, for example, what if you miss a few samples and you don't know where, and or you make some errors in the measurement, or you don't know exactly when you took the measurement, how do you handle those errors? How do they propagate? This is roughly what the field of sampling theory is about. But of course, for us, it's a matter of principle, not a matter of practicality. So then the properties of band-limited functions. Band-limited functions are wonderful. Their calculus is great. You see, if you know that you're dealing with functions that are band-limited and you know their band limit, then for you, differential operators are now also finite difference operators, because everything you do on the continuous function, you can do on its samples. And differential equations are also finite difference equations then, but without approximation. It just are. Integrals are also series. This is exact, not an approximation. In fact, that has been used, for example, in pure math, in analytic number theory. You may have some tedious theories to sum up, but how many tricks do we have to sum up series? Very few. If you write your series as an integral, by interpreting your terms as the sample values of a band-limited function, then you can use that it's also an integral and then apply tricks of integration, like contour integration, for example, to that.
If it's band-limited, then seems to me you can always consider it a periodic function if you want, then just by Fourier series.
No. It doesn't have to be periodic, just because it's band-limited.
You can, if its bandwidth, then you might as well, one way to approach it is to extend it, imagine it being extended to be periodic. So
you're talking about the frequency domain.
Sorry?
In the frequency domain. In the frequency domain, it has a finite support. And then if you choose periodic boundary conditions on that, that gives you a particular lattice. If you choose periodic boundary conditions up to a phase, it gives you another lattice. And there are many more ways of doing that, and they correspond to the choices of sampling lattices that you have. So what then is covariant band limitation? How can we do these things covariantly for physics? Well, it means that we cut off the spectrum of the Laplacian or the D'Alembertian. Because what are frequencies other than eigenvalues of a differential operator? So the covariant way of implementing such a band limitation in quantum field theory is then, and I'm writing here just the simple case of a scalar field, we write down the partition function, and instead of summing over all fields, we don't even really know what function space that ought to be, but we now limit that function space to the space of functions spanned by the eigenfunctions of the Laplacian or D'Alembertian, depending on whether it's Euclidean or Lorentzian, such that the eigenvalues lie in a particular interval. If you do that on flat space, it's just ordinary band limitation. On flat Euclidean space, it's ordinary band limitation, but it's a covariant version of it that you can also do on curved space-time. So you can also view it like this. The path integral tells us that most of what's happening with the field is classical. However, because of the stationary phase approximation. However, we really sum over all sorts of fluctuations. We sum over things that are arbitrarily far off shell. And this is cutting off, this band limitation is cutting off how far off shell quantum fluctuations we still take into account, not too extreme. So what then if physical fields are band limited? Well, then they possess equivalent representations on a differentiable space-time manifold, which shows that we can keep external symmetries. For example, if there are killing vector fields, there still are after that cutting of the path integral, or after that implementation of a band limitation. On the other hand, we can also represent our fields on any lattice of sufficiently dense spacing. And it doesn't break any symmetries. Just like we didn't do any harm to the music signal, to a band-limited music signal, by choosing a particular lattice to take its samples. When you reconstruct a music signal, there's no memory of the lattice from which you reconstructed it. And so similarly here. But if you do then represent your field on a lattice, that shows that you have discretized it and you can have ultraviolet finiteness. So what then is the density of degrees of freedom? This question is complicated in the Lorentzian case, and I don't have the time to explain how far we got with this. It's relatively simple though in the Euclidean case. So Euclidean quantum field theory, we can use a key result by Gilkey of 1975. Gilkey showed that when you have a compact four-dimensional Riemannian manifold, then, in this case, we're working with the Laplacian of the manifold. So let's say we work with a Klein-Gordon field on a compact Riemannian four-dimensional manifold. Then Gilkey's result says that the number of eigenvalues of the Laplacian below a cutoff, and the cutoff we call lambda, so that would be our band limitation, cutting off the spectrum of the Laplacian. The number of eigenvalues that remain, and therefore the number of eigenfunctions that remain after we implement that cutoff, and therefore the dimensionality of the Hilbert space of scalar fields that remains, is given by that expression here. That is also, now we see from the perspective of sampling theory, this is also the number of samples that you have to take in order to capture a field completely. Generally, if your function space is five-dimensional, and you know five amplitudes of an arbitrary function, then you can reconstruct what it does everywhere, because every function is given by five coefficients relative to a basis. So you have five unknowns to determine. If you know five amplitudes of the function, then you can determine those five coefficients in front of the five basis vectors. So,
this doesn't look like Nyquist's
formula. No, it's not. It's not. It's Weyl's asymptotic formula. It's Weyl's asymptotic formula. Nyquist's theorem is. Okay, so here I'm talking about a situation that's simpler. We are working here on a compact Riemannian manifold. This is finite volume. If you band limit that, you get away with taking just a finite number of samples. If you work with Shannon's original theory, it functions on the real line. You have to take infinitely many samples for that. We recover that case by letting the volume go to infinity. But for now, this is still finite volume. This is the number, the overall total number of sample points that you have where you have to record the amplitude of a scalar field such that you can reconstruct it everywhere.
For which resolution? Hmm? For which resolution?
Oh, here the lambda. Lambda is the cutoff, is the ultraviolet cutoff. Yeah. So you choose that, and then that's the number of eigenvalues, that's the number of eigenfunctions, that's the dimension of the function space. And so this is the number of sample points that we have to take to capture a scalar field completely. Now, we can read off several things from that. One is that if there is no curvature, let's say this is just a torus or something. So let's say if there's no curvature, then we see that the density of degrees of freedom, the density of samples you have to take is n divided by, well, this, the volume, right? So the volume is really just the cutoff. So you can interpret this thing here, and of course you know this already, this looks like the Einstein action. This is looking like a cosmological constant, the Ricci scalar, and then higher order curvature terms that are very much suppressed. So what we see here is that in the absence of curvature, you can interpret the cosmological constant as setting the density of degrees of freedom. Because you can just divide through that volume, and you get n divided by the volume is cosmological constant. However, what does curvature do? Curvature messes this up. Curvature is modulating that. You can view from this point of view curvature as modulating the density of degrees of freedom, the density of sample points that you have to take in order to record a signal, or in this case, a scalar field completely. So n over v, that would be the density of degrees of freedom, the Nyquist rate. You see, at this point, you can then take the volume to infinity. This, the cosmological constant is giving you the density of degrees of freedom, and then curvature is perturbing that. What I would find fascinating is if this could also work the other way around. It's clear that given the curvature, this will modulate the density of degrees of freedom. But maybe the density of degrees of freedom can actually be viewed also as arising from maybe we can also work the other way around. If you're given the density of degrees of freedom, you can calculate the curvature. Now, clearly, this is a scalar thing. You can only get a scalar. But there are different kinds of fields, scalar fields, vector fields, tensorial fields. If you knew all of their density of degrees of freedom locally, you might be able to calculate what the curvature is of the space-time. So curvature would be just an expression of the varying density of degrees of freedom, the Nyquist rate, the sample densities that you have to take in order to capture a field completely. So using Gilkey's formula, we can re-express the Einstein action. So the Einstein action can be, all we do here, from here to the next slide, is that I'm putting the right factor in front such that we get the right factor in front of the Ricci scalar, right? Trivial exercise. What we get is that the Einstein action therefore takes this form. It's 6 pi over lambda times the number of degrees of freedom. But the number of degrees of freedom below the cutoff, the number of eigenvalues below the cutoff, is the number of eigenfunctions that we are left with. It's the trace of 1. The trace of the identity is just the number of, just the dimension of the Hilbert space. So in other words, the Einstein action then takes, if we allow ourselves in the Einstein action to take this cosmological constant along, it's still 120 orders of magnitude too large. Sorry, I don't have an answer to that. And if we allow this extra junk that is very, very small also to come along, then we can write that the Einstein action is just 6 pi over lambda times the trace of the identity, which is nice because any other action can also be written as a trace. For example, the Klein-Gordon action can be written as this trace. So in other words, the total action can always be written as a trace. And if you want the Einstein action as well, just add a 1 plus. It's just the identity plus, not actually just the identity, it's 6 pi over lambda times the identity, and that will take care of having gravity in there as well. Now that was all about band limitation of fields. Is there such a thing as band limiting space-time itself? Is there Shannon-like reconstruction of space from discrete sets of samples? Now, you see, this leads to, physically speaking, this leads to the following question. Einstein formulated general relativity, starting with explaining what coordinate systems are. You have to have standard rods and standard clocks and distribute them, synchronize them, and then you know what your coordinate systems are, and relative to that, you can then formulate general relativity. But on the subatomic scale, there are no rulers or clocks that you could use. Everything is made out of quantum fields ultimately. So how can we build this framework of GR on fields and not on these complicated objects that are clocks and rods? Here's the idea. Let us use noise correlators as proxies for distances. Instead of measuring distances with a ruler, let us measure distances by measuring how correlated quantum fluctuations are here with quantum fluctuations over there. The closer the two points are, the more correlated are the quantum fluctuations going to be. So the correlator size tells us about the distance. The further away, the smaller the correlator, and vice versa. But why are quantum fluctuations here correlated with quantum fluctuations there at all? Well, they're correlated because quantum fields have entanglement in the ground state. They are entangled because they are harmonic oscillators that are coupled, and in their ground state, coupled harmonic oscillators have entanglement. Concretely, let's say you are the curator of a museum and you have a dinosaur there, and you're very worried. Yesterday we had a fire in town. What if a fire were to happen in this museum that you are in charge of? So what you do is you want to record at least information about the dinosaur. You can do is you can put a lot, you can sprinkle a lot of points on the dinosaur and then measure the mutual distances between any two points and put those mutual distances in a big matrix. Point I, point J, what's the distance? It's a matrix element. But instead of measuring the distance, measure the strength of the correlator. Measure the strength of the propagator, really. You see, the propagator gives you the two-point function, two-point correlation function. In Euclidean theory, it's just the Whiteman function, which is 1 over the Laplacian. It's the matrix element of the 1 over the Laplacian. So what you do is you measure the quantum fluctuations here and measure how correlated they are with the quantum fluctuations there, and so on. You get a huge matrix of quantum fluctuations. And then you go home and are happy because you have your matrix stored in the cloud. And sure enough, the museum burns down. But you have your matrix. You have your matrix of mutual distances or mutual correlators. And in general, there is no way to put together an object that will have all the same correlators other than this. You cannot put together an elephant that has the same matrix of correlators than that. It's unique.
So you mean you can reconstruct this metric, not Riemann metric, I mean the distance.
You get the distances between them up to the resolution that you chose with the sprinkling. Yes.
So this reminds me of Kahn's distance formula, actually, because there he also gets the geodesic distance from Dirac, actually.
I will make a comment about the Dirac operator later. Here I'm working with the Laplacian. Okay. Right, and so it turns out that if you know all those distances, you can reconstruct the metric, and there's also a paper coming up with Aslanbegi and Saravani here at Perimeter. Now, the thing is this, that of course, you captured the shape of the dinosaur here up to the resolution that you chose, but there was this huge ambiguity in how you sprinkled your points. It turns out that the ambiguity in sprinkling the points is the ambiguity in choosing those position eigenvectors, is the ambiguity in choosing a basis, and what basis-independent information is in a Hermitian matrix like this. It's the eigenvalues. So really, the basis-independent information in such a recording is the eigenvalues of the matrix, which is the eigenvalues of 1 over the Laplacian or the eigenvalues of the Laplacian. And there, we arrived in a new way at spectral geometry. Spectral geometry is the discipline of mathematics which asks, to what extent can we reconstruct the shape of a manifold from knowing its spectrum, from knowing the spectrum of the Laplacian on it? Okay, so we arrived at another reason for why that should work, why spectral geometry should work. By the way, spectral geometry is fascinating because it's older than quantum mechanics. It goes back to 1904, 1905, Weyl came up with these ideas. And it's relating the math of quantum theory, functional analysis, spectra, to the math of general relativity, differential geometry, right? But it precedes the problem that I'm suggesting it might help to solve. So does the spectrum tell the shape? We know that if you just take the matrix, yeah, that will tell the shape, but I'm saying something much stronger. The spectrum alone might tell what the shape is. Don't need to record all of the matrix, just the spectrum. So here's spectral geometry. Here's the vase, and here's the spectrum of the vase. If you tap with a spoon onto that vase, then the Laplacian spectrum on that vase, that spectrum tells us something about the shape of the vase. How much does it tell about it?
Not completely, definitely not completely.
Well, we get to that. So the prospect is that if this were to work, and some of you are aware that there are stumbling blocks, if this were to work, then we would have the following situation. The curvature of space-time can be measured in two ways. One way would be to look out there, check for Einstein rings, and so on, the usual astronomical way of measuring space-time curvature. But there would now be also another way of calculating the shape of the curvature of space, namely this way. This is a lady at the University of Toronto, and what she's measuring using a homodyne detector, a quantum optical homodyne detector, is vacuum fluctuations of the electromagnetic field. She's listening to the noise of the vacuum. You see, here, you need a spoon to make that ring and listen to the sound of it. But if you hear it, maybe you can tell what the shape is without looking. Can calculate that. Clearly, different vases will have different sounds, right? And here the idea would be, she's listening to the noise of the vacuum. Maybe she can tell what the curvature of space-time is as a matter of principle. It's not going to be practical at all. It's much too weak a signal, but in principle, the quantum noise should sound differently depending on what the curvature of space-time is. And maybe, just maybe, there's enough information in the sound, in the quantum fluctuations, in the entanglement of the vacuum, to tell what all of the curvature is. So this could be a rather deep link between gravity and quantum theory, between the entanglement of the vacuum, which gives us, which impacts the noise of the vacuum, and gravity and curvature. So, but there's a problem. Spectral geometry has counterexamples. For curved spaces, it has counterexamples, but also even on the plane already, if you look at planar domains, there are counterexamples. This object and that object would have the same vibration spectrum, but you can't rotate the one into the other. They are really different. So what should we do now? Give up? No, we seem to be so close. Let's fix it. Let's try to fix spectral geometry. And we try to fix it with a more modest, fresh approach. You see, spectral geometry is hard because of nonlinearity. And pure mathematicians like to either do something or not. They either prove it, or they disprove it, or they don't tackle it. But as physicists, we have perturbation theory, right? And so that is the trick. Let us throw perturbation theory at spectral geometry. And that's what I call infinitesimal spectral geometry, which is to say, the old problem is, give me the spectrum And I'll try to calculate the shape for you. Very hard nonlinear problem. The simpler problem of infinitesimal spectral geometry is this. Give me the shape and give me the sound of it, both the spectrum and the shape. And now let somebody change the shape. I'm not looking, change the shape. And then give me the change of sound. From a small change of sound, I would like to calculate a small change of shape. This is now a linear problem, see? If the changes are small enough. So the idea is, you assume you know the shape, assume you know the spectrum, and now somebody changes the shape a bit and doesn't tell you how, but tells you how the sound changed. Can you then calculate how the shape changed? So we have that the metric goes into a perturbed metric, the spectrum goes into a perturbed spectrum. So for example, we take, for the vase, this is the metric on the vase, just the surface of the vase, and then we perturb the metric in this way with this conformal factor, which is what we can always do, because it's two-dimensional, and then we expand our function f, this scalar function that lives on the vase, that describes the perturbation of the shape of the vase, a bump, a dent in the vase, a bulge in the vase, described by f of x. We can expand that function f in the eigenbasis of the Laplace operator, which is a canonical thing to do. So now, the perturbations of the shape are the coefficients of f in the eigenbasis of the Laplace operator. So shape changes are described by this set of discrete coefficients. On the other hand, when we change the shape, this will generally change the sound as well. So the eigenvalues go into the same eigenvalues plus some perturbations, mu n. So the change of sound is described by a discrete bunch of numbers, mu n. And clearly, if you have the change of shape described by the coefficients fm, then this will linearly, with some as yet unknown matrix S, produce changes in the sound. The question is now, can we invert S? First, can we calculate it? And then, can we invert it? Turns out we can calculate that, because as you change the shape, you're changing the Laplacian. It's like changing a Hamiltonian. You can do perturbation theory on the spectrum, first order perturbation theory, and you can straightforwardly write down what the change of the spectrum is going to be. And so you can calculate what that matrix S is. These are the matrix elements of the matrix S and M, the matrix that connects the changes of shape coefficients to the changes of sound coefficients. This matrix has these matrix elements. It's the eigenfunctions of the Laplacian, and this is the change in the Laplacian due to the shape. Just like first-order perturbation theory in quantum mechanics, it's the unperturbed eigenfunctions, and this is the perturbation Hamiltonian, and that's the change. That's the matrix that does that. Now, let's further assume that we have finite vision and finite hearing, so that this becomes a finite dimensional matrix. In other words, we put an ultraviolet cutoff on it. We put a band limitation on it. We put a band limitation on the spectrum of the Laplacian. Now our Hilbert space is finite dimensional, and what do we have? We don't see the shape entirely exactly. We don't hear all of the eigenvalues. We hear only up to a certain maximum frequency. We see only down to a certain length scale of wriggles because the eigenfunctions break off at a certain point. We have only the first n of them. And then let's count dimensions. And we find that the number of eigenvalues is the same as the number of eigenfunctions if we also take into account possible degeneracies. So in other words, we have exactly as many coefficients of shape change as we have coefficients of sound change. And generically, this is going to be there for a square matrix with generic entries. The determinant would not normally be zero, which means that it can be inverted, and that means this should work. We should be able to calculate from small changes of sound what the small changes of shape are. And then, if we're lucky, we can iterate that and go from small changes of shape, from reconstructing small changes of shape all the way to reconstructing large changes of shape as well. However, wasn't there something? There were counterexamples. What happened with the counterexample? Well, it turns out what happened with the counterexamples is that we made a too stringent assumption. For two-dimensional manifolds such as the vase, it is true that the perturbations of the metric are always of a conformal form, not in higher dimensions. What can we do about this? Well,
that wasn't a counterexample in
Not for curvature. Yes, for planar domains where it's a matter of the boundary. But for curvature, no, you have to go to higher dimensions there. So what do we do then? Well, okay, the perturbations of the metric really are of this form, where there are vector and tensor perturbations as well, as we know very well from inflationary cosmology, for example. So what we have to do is we have to listen to the sound, not just of scalar waves, but also the sound of vector waves and the sound of covariant symmetric two tensor waves. It's just like in seismology, where they know very well that when earthquake happens, you better listen not just to the scalar pressure waves, you also listen to the tensorial shear waves. They have different information. For example, shear waves don't propagate into the liquid interior of the Earth because liquids don't support shear. So there's different information of the different speed of sound propagation and so on. Different information in geology, in different kinds of waves, and the same in physics. And we missed out on that. We have to take that into account. If we do this, if we expand these perturbations in the eigenfunctions of the Laplacians of corresponding waves, of vectorial waves or covariant symmetric two tensor waves, for this part, for the truly tensorial part, then we are again at the situation where we have the same number of degrees of freedom of change of shape and the same number of degrees of freedom of change of sound. Because now we have more Laplacians. So overall, I'm going to rush a little bit. Overall, what we find is that shape and sound dimensions match again, and it should work. This is very difficult to work out numerically. For the two-dimensional case, we published a PRL showing that you can actually do this, that you can iterate that and get shapes from sound. For the higher dimensional, we haven't done that for curvature yet. But you see, the picture that's emerging here is that, as I said, you might get at curvature, you might be able to express curvature in terms of the quantum noise. Now, key challenges are that we need to go from 2 to 4 dimensions for curved space times, and especially to 3+1 dimensions. For this purpose, we need the spectra of Laplacians on 0, 1, and 2 tensors, and of course of D'Alembertians. A question that arises, and this is linking it up with the work of Alan Kahn and Carlo Rovelli and others, is what about the Dirac operator? Well, if in terms of the eigenfunctions of the Dirac operator, you can express the perturbations of the metric, all perturbations of the metric, if you can do that, then you can replicate that, right? But I'm not sure you can. I'm just not sure. I don't know the math of it. If you can do it, then that should be possible. Then the spectrum of the Dirac operator may be enough. But we do know that it should be enough to work with the Laplacians as long as you work with Laplacians on scalars, vectors, and covariant symmetric two tensors. Because in terms of their eigenfunctions, you can express all perturbations of the metric. Not so sure about the Dirac operator. Right, now the speaker after me is my PhD student, Mikhail Panin, who did great work on implementing that kind of idea to the very hard case of spectral geometry in the plane, where we have plenty of counterexamples. There's even a mechanism for producing counterexamples. For example, as I said earlier, that this object would have the same vibration spectrum as that object. And Mikhail is going to tell you about the outcome of our studies in that regard.
They are C-circumference. Hmm? They look C-circumference.
Yes, you can actually cut and paste them into each other. Right. And also what seems to be important is that they have non-differentiable boundaries there. Because in short, Mikhail found that it works. And yet we have counterexamples. So, you know, there is some, well, but I don't want to steal all of his thunder there. Or maybe that. We don't know yet. We don't know yet.
I think there's no convex counterexamples.
That may be, yes. Right, okay, and then maybe just very briefly, experimental predictions. You can implement that cutoff in quantum field theory and then apply that to inflationary cosmology. A big question here is the impact on the predictions for the CMB are either linear in the ratio of the two scales involved, namely Planck length over Hubble length during inflation, which is about 10 to the minus 5, or it's quadratic. If the signature of the effect is proportional to the ratio of Planck length over Hubble length, then the effect is about 10 to the minus 5, which means it's ruled out to be seen with current experiments and even planned experiments. But in the future, it's not completely ruled out that we might measure an effect like that. On the other hand, if the effect is quadratic in that ratio of Planck length over Hubble length, then it's an effect of 10 to the minus 10 on top of this, which is 10 to the minus 6 effect already, right? So that seems very unlikely to be measurable. It turns out that the non-covariant version of this band limitation produces a square effect, too small. But just last week, in work with Robert Martin of the University of Cape Town and Aidan Chatwin Davis of Caltech, we worked it out after almost 3 years of hard work. It's linear. So in the relative, when you do the cutoff relativistically, then there is an impact on the CMB predictions. And fortunately, it is not too small. It is as small as it is as large as it could possibly be, which is it looks like it's linear in that ratio of Planck length over Hubble length. Right. So summary is. The philosophy seems to emerge that information theory plays a role at the Planck scale, and in our case here, it comes in through band limitation and the sampling theorem. Space-time may be band limited. in this case, discreteness is the same as continuous. It's equivalent. The same way for space-time as is the case for information. And the notion of distance may be replaceable by the notion of the information theoretic notion of correlation. The more correlated quantum fluctuations are, the closer they are, the smaller is the distance. And a key challenge is, while we've done some of this work in the Lorentz covariant way, much of it is still Euclidean. And with the Euclidean signature, and the key challenge is to generalize that to the fully Lorentz covariant case. Thank you very much.
I was a bit confused about what you said about the green function. You said it could reconstruct the shape entirely. And then you said it had more information than the eigenvalues. And then you said, but that's only just the choice of basis.
Oh, yes, yes, yes. Oh, very good.
You can't reconstruct the shape. So
very good.
All that didn't actually add up, didn't all make sense together.
Very good. You put your finger there on the spot that I wanted to explain, and I completely forgot that. Oh, where are we here? Oh, it's a little later. Here it is, right. Okay, so what we said is that if you keep the matrix, then you can reconstruct the shape because it will fit together only in one way. See, if you have all those mutual distances, it's really overdetermining the shape. There's no way around it.
Is that a theorem about just ordinary distance?
Yeah, I think it is. And it goes back, these considerations go back to Gauss already. Yeah. So there's no question about it. But the question was then, if we change the sprinkling, then we change the basis, and the only basis-independent information in that matrix is the spectrum. So therefore, well, the spectrum should have all information, right? But then couldn't we do that in four dimensions? And where would be the contradiction here? Right? Because after all, we know now it cannot work in four dimensions with just one Laplacian. We have to take the Laplacian vectors and tensors as well. The way out is very subtle. It works like this. You see, if you change the sprinkling, you're changing the basis vectors here in which you represent that matrix. However, you're not getting every basis this way. You're only getting position basis this way. And if you ask, what information in that matrix is invariant under all changes of basis? The answer is the spectrum. But if you ask the question, which information in that matrix is invariant under basis changes that can be obtained by changing position vectors there, that's more. And that more is negligible in 2D, but not in higher dimensions. It's a very subtle thing. It's fantastic that you saw that. Yes.
Intuitively, I normally think if you do a calculation in a more symmetric way, you know, that you might expect extra cancellation in a smaller answer, but that you wouldn't get a bigger answer. What happens is there an intuitive reason that you get an answer that's so much bigger when you do a cutoff covariantly instead of non-covariantly?
That's a very good question. I don't know the answer to that. You see, we just found that result like last week. I mean, 4 days ago. And we were very excited. We expected, as you did, that you know it would be a small effect again. But I don't know what makes it larger. It's really a different setup. You see, if you have a covariant, if you have a non-covariant cutoff, so if you say there is a finite smallest wavelength and that's it, then so you cut off the Laplacian, not the D'Alembertian, then each mode comes into existence. Only when its co-moving mode comes into existence, only when its wavelength starts to exceed the Planck length. That's a different physics from doing it covariantly, where there really isn't the smallest wavelength in space alone. Instead, you have this interplay. Maybe that's the answer. I don't know yet. In the covariant case, sampling theory works out this way, that for every spatial mode, you have a temporal sampling theorem. For every temporal mode, you have a spatial sampling theorem. And somehow they're intertwined, and maybe that intertwining is pulling up more effects. I don't know what it is, but it's a different physics because co-moving modes don't get created. Co-moving modes always exist in the fully covariant setting. Yeah?
In your notation, if we assume that f of x, which was our perturbation function, if that's the, let's assume it's the first eigenfunction of Laplacian, do we know that only the first eigenvalue of Laplacian will change?
No, of course not. It's not that easy. It's much more complicated, yeah. Yes, so if you change the shape in a particular way, this will, with one eigenfunction, for example, this will generally change the spectrum everywhere. In other words, that matrix S is very far from being diagonal. It's mostly true that, I mean, your intuition is right let me put it this way.
In your notation,
yeah.
the F, when we expand in the basis, it has just one coefficient.
Yes.
So basically, our matrix was just one number, your S.
Oh, yeah, but that's very crude then. I mean, you could have the cutoff so low that it's just one number, but then it's very, very crude. But you see, the intuition behind this, I think you have the right intuition. Generally speaking, the overall large-scale features are described by the low eigenvectors and by the low eigenvalues. And the finer features, the smaller wavelength things, are described by the higher eigenvalues and their eigenfunctions. Generally, that is true. It's just not clean in the sense that you get a diagonal matrix. But generally, it's still true that the scales are separated. Which is necessary, because otherwise an ultraviolet cutoff wouldn't make any sense, because you could do something at the low eigenvalues, and it would affect the high eigenvalues dramatically, and that's not happening.
I think we should probably go on. Thanks very much again.
Thank you.